Moscow denies reports it has expelled U.S. ambassador amid soaring tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine conflict. Iran's foreign minister says there is no military solution for the Ukraine crisis, urging more political efforts to end the conflict. And the Yemeni foreign minister denounces UN Security Council's, quote, shameful and ridiculous resolution, which extends an arms embargo on the Ansarullah movement. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. It's the eighth day of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Moscow now claims to have taken over Kherson, a southern Ukrainian port city on the Black Sea.
Russian armed forces have taken the city of Kherson under total control. Civilian infrastructure, critical infrastructure, and public transport work as usual. There is no shortage of groceries or staple goods.
Ukrainian officials have denied Russia's claim, with the mayor of the city saying Russian troops are in the streets and have forced their way into the city council building. In the capital, Kiev, there was a blast near a central train station. Ukrainian officials claimed that the explosion was caused by falling wreckage of a downed missile. There are also claims over 7,000 Russian troops have been killed since start of the operation, but the Russian Defense Ministry has put the number of its fatalities at around 500. Ministry says nearly 3,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed and nearly 4,000 wounded. A prosecutor for the International Criminal Court has confirmed that a probe into possible war crimes will soon be launched. This as Russia and Ukraine are getting prepared for a second round of ceasefire talks.
We generally found common ground on a number of issues, even at the negotiating table. But on some of the most fundamental of them, the Ukrainian side took time to think and consult with Kiev.
The Russian foreign minister says Moscow is ready to discuss a request by Ukraine for security guarantees, calling it a positive step. Tensions have dramatically increased between the West and Russia over the conflict, and now Sweden says that four Russian fighter jets briefly violated its airspace, calling it very serious. The U.S. says it will postpone a scheduled test launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile in a bid to de-escalate with Russia's nuclear tensions. This after Moscow ordered its nuclear forces to be put on alert. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign ministry has denied reports Moscow expelled the American ambassador. Russia is hit with more sanctions as the conflict between Moscow and Kiev continues. U.S. government has announced a new round of sanctions on Russia, including measures which ban the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, the European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from Global SWIFT payment system. Bloc has also banned two major news networks, Russia Today and Sputnik. In recent days, Moscow has retaliated with sanctions and restrictions of its own. Moscow has also warned that Germany's decision to freeze the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project could damage ties and lead to a rapid and inevitable rise in gas prices. UN General Assembly has voted overwhelmingly to deplore Russia's military operation against Ukraine. With the 193-member body has adopted a resolution which calls on Russia to withdraw its troops from the country. During the emergency session, 141 members voted in favor of the resolution. Five countries, including Russia, said no to it, while 35 abstained. Addressing the meeting, Ukraine's ambassador accused Moscow of seeking to commit genocide in his country, warning Russia's aggression is not stopped. It will spill over to other areas. However, the Russian representative criticized the resolution, saying it may spark further escalation. Vasily Nebenzia blamed Ukraine and its Western allies for the ongoing conflict and accused them of killing people in the Donbas region. He also dismissed claims the Russian military has targeted civilians. Iran says the U.S. and NATO are to blame for the ongoing Russian military action against Ukraine. Majid Takht Ravanchi, Iran's ambassador to the U.N., also accused Washington and NATO of exacerbating the situation in Eastern Europe with provocative actions that he said are the root cause of this conflict. The Iranian diplomat said text of the resolution before the General Assembly lacked impartiality and realistic mechanisms to resolve the crisis through peaceful means. He stressed not all UN members were given the opportunity to engage in negotiations on the text, adding that's why the Iranian delegation abstained from voting on it. Ken Stone is an activist with the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. He tells us how the confrontation between Moscow and Kiev has been in the making now for years.
This conflict has been 30 years in the making because in 1990, the U.S. gave Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Russian president, assurances that if he agreed to reunify Germany, NATO would not expand even one inch to the east. And of course, the U.S. and NATO has expanded NATO, its military alliance, 800 kilometers to the east and taken up 14 countries. And then they had a coup. The U.S. sponsored a coup in Ukraine, which put a government in power with Nazis in it, who proceeded to launch a war of aggression against its own Russian-speaking minority in the Donbass. So this conflict, as Iran says, was 100% engineered by the U.S. and NATO. It was bound to happen, and Russia is not to blame. Russia is merely reacting to its own security interests, which many observers of the international scene had predicted would result in an armed conflict if Russia's security demands on Ukraine were not met.
Iran's foreign minister says there is no military solution to the Ukraine crisis, calling for more political efforts to resolve ongoing conflict. Hossein Amri Abdollahian made the remark during a phone call with president of the International Committee of the Red Cross. He told Peter Maurer Iran's Red Crescent Society is ready to assist victims of the conflict and called for coordination relief efforts between the two organizations. Peter Maurer, for his part, described the situation in Ukraine as critical, stressing priorities of the ICRC is to send more humanitarian aid into the country, facilitate return of dead bodies, and reach out to detainees. UN says nearly 900,000 people have already fled Ukraine. Meanwhile, the Ukraine crisis is shedding a light on racism, which lies at the heart of UK immigration and asylum policies. People say Westminster is favoring European refugees over those from West Asia and Africa. Bianca Rahimi explains.
The Home Office has verified that the majority of people trying to reach the UK's shores via the English Channel are fleeing war and persecution. This comes in response to allegations made by the Home Secretary that the majority are illegitimate, in her own words, asylum shoppers.
If the laws that they're trying to put through Parliament at the present time, if they had been in process at the time that the present Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the time her family came as refugees and asylum seekers from Uganda, they would not have been allowed to come into the United Kingdom. Or if they did come into the United Kingdom, they would be put into some sort of detention camps that she is advocating.
The issue of Ukrainian refugees also got off to a rocky start, with the Home Secretary suggesting they could benefit from fruit picker visas. Now, under pressure, the government is offering emergency visas for those with family members already living in Britain. But at the same time, the government is pushing through legislation that will criminalise those coming from the Middle East and Africa, specifically via the English Channel, and people protesting this are getting mixed responses.
It's interesting that while we've been reporting here today, we have heard people pass by making some pretty off-colour remarks about refugees arriving here in this country. And that just confirms that there is a lack of sympathy here. And some would say those sentiments stem from misinformation, but most importantly, from racism.
White skin, blue eyes. They've said it on the media. White skin, blue eyes means you're acceptable. If you're brown-skinned or black-skinned, you're not acceptable. and it's a form of apartheid.
There are people who have been driven to suicide after arriving in Britain. There were actually more people dying after being in the hands of the Home Office here than the numbers that have been dying crossing the Channel. And that is crazy to think that the hope and the aspiration that drives a person to risk their life, the kind of Britain that they're hoping for, is the one we want to live in. But it's not the one we have. It's what we have is deeply driven, divided by racism.
The Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK extraordinary powers to criminalise, prosecute and imprison refugees, and give the Coast Guard immunity from prosecution if refugees die at sea. There have been widespread protests demanding this bill be scrapped, specifically now that the government is poised to issue hundreds of thousands of visas for Ukrainians, proving that when there's a will, there's a way. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A court in Denmark sentences three leaders of an anti-Iran terror group to up to 8 years in prison for espionage. Habib Yabur Khabi, his brother Tamim Farouk Bek, and son-in-law belong to the so-called Arab Struggle Movement for the Liberation of Ahvaz. Last month, a Danish court found them guilty of creating a spy unit for a Saudi intelligence service. They were also convicted of promoting terrorism. In September 2018, the terrorist group claimed responsibility for an attack on a military parade in Ahvaz, in southern Iran, which killed 25 people. Iran has in the past said the group is backed by Saudi Arabia. Iran once again calls for the release of Afghanistan's frozen assets, saying economic revival and people's livelihoods in the war-torn nation should not be politicized. Speaking at a UN Security Council session on Afghanistan, Iran's deputy ambassador called for urgent action to prevent the Afghan economy from collapsing. Zahra Ershadi noted nearly half of Afghanistan's population is in dire need of humanitarian assistance. The Iranian diplomat also expressed deep concerns over the catastrophic consequences of the situation for the security and stability of the region. She warned if the Afghan situation is not addressed effectively, it could lead to a massive influx of refugees into neighboring countries. The U.S. has frozen all Afghan assets following a Taliban takeover of the country in August of last year. Iran's foreign minister says a revival of the 2015 deal hinges on political decisions and a realistic approach by the U.S. and Europe. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment in a phone call with his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi. He added that JCPOA revival talks have to safeguard Iran's interests. Top Chinese diplomats said Beijing supports Iran's rational demands. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal are still engaged in negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Tehran says talks have to lead to the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. It also wants guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again. The Palestinians have held a funeral for a man shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank last Tuesday. Hundreds of people attended a ceremony which took place in the Arub refugee camp north of the city of Al-Khalil. Israeli forces reportedly attacked mourners with rubber bullets and tear gas, leading to dozens of cases of suffocation. Ammar Shafiq Abu Afifa was shot dead near the city of Bethlehem. Israeli forces for several hours refused to hand his body over to Palestinians. Abu Afifa was the third Palestinian killed in separate Israeli raids on Tuesday. Meanwhile, people have taken to the streets in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah to voice support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Advocacy groups are holding prison authorities fully responsible for the deteriorating situation inside Israeli jails amid mounting tensions triggered by tough restrictions on prisoners' daily lives. Mona Kandil has your story.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it. And we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Yemeni foreign minister denounces as shameful and ridiculous a UN Security Council resolution extending an arms embargo on the Ansarullah movement. Hisham Sharaf said UAE proposed motion has turned the spotlight on the UN body's double standards. He added the move shows the Security Council serves the interests of Abu Dhabi and Riyadh, which are committing acts of aggression against Yemen. Resolution was adopted Monday. It came in the wake of retaliatory attacks by the Ansarullah movement against Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Yemenis say their reprisal attacks are aimed at pushing the Saudi-led coalition, which includes the UAE, to stop its war against Yemen, which has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, the majority of them civilians. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, police officers fear retaliation if they step in to stop misconduct by other police officers. In the wake of George Floyd's death, police departments are trying to change that. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Shayla Dewan. The piece is titled, A New Message for Police. If you see something, say something. On an early Monday morning in a chilly classroom in Baltimore, Maryland, a diverse group of recruits to one of the nation's most troubled police departments gathered for a new kind of training. The screen flashed a photo of a man whose face is now familiar to the world. "What happened to George Floyd?" the instructor barked. "He was lynched," one trainee responded. "He was murdered," another trainee said. "How many other police officers were there?" the instructor asked. Many knew the answer. 3. That was the crux of the matter at hand. Not the senior officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck, Derek Chauvin, but the 3 others who did not stop him. The question of what other police officers could or should have done was not abstract. More than 1,000 miles away, those same 3 former police officers, 2 of them ranked rookies, were standing trial on charges that they failed to prevent the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May of 2020. On Thursday, they were convicted and could face many years in prison. For decades, many police critics have complained that police officers who allow police misconduct to happen do more damage to the community's trust than the police officers who commit it. Yet, they have not been a focus. When Rodney King was tased and beaten by 4 Los Angeles police officers in 1991, more than 12 other police officers looked on. None of the onlookers faced charges. The federal trial of 2 Tao, J. Alexander Kung, and Thomas Lane in Minnesota this month was one of the rare attempts to hold police officers to account over the issue. The duty to stop a fellow police officer who is engaging in misconduct has long been embedded in many department policies and upheld by the courts of law. But the defendants in Minnesota argued that during their training, it was little more than a word on a PowerPoint. Police officers across the United States have been told they must intervene if they see a fellow police officer behave in misconduct, but they have not necessarily been taught how to do so. George Floyd's death has begun to change that. More than 215 police departments have signed up for a Georgetown University program that teaches police officers the philosophy and techniques of intervention. Watching the Floyd video, you're thinking the only thing that could have snapped any one of those police officers out of it would have been for another one of them to intervene, said Chief Kelly McCarthy of Mendota Heights, a Minneapolis suburb, whose department has begun to use the training. Dallas, Seattle, Los Angeles, Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and all of New Jersey are also participating. Active bystander training is not new. The airline industry and hospitals have used it to empower co-pilots and nurses to speak up to prevent mistakes. And it has even been used to help stop sexual assault on college campuses. Its use in policing began in New Orleans in 2016, after a number of police officers faced criminal charges, including a rookie who went to prison for helping cover up a fatal beating perpetrated by his training officer. But other police departments have been slow to adopt such programs for many reasons. The paramilitary structure of law enforcement agencies discourages questioning the chain of command, and departments have a long track record of retaliating against whistleblowers. Police officers who break the culture of silence risk being passed over for promotions or even being fired themselves, as Cariel Horn in Buffalo, New York, was after she stopped a white police officer from choking a black subject. To overcome these barriers, trainees are told that program is not about ratting about their comrades, but stopping them from committing misconduct in the first place. They are told to think of police officers in need of intervention as humans who get tired and stressed and make mistakes, and of themselves as helpers who can respond to warning signs of mental illness, addiction, or suicide. Intervention, the premise goes, is just one more way that police officers take care of one another. We get an opportunity to redefine this whole freaking thing about the thin blue line, redefine what it means to have each other's back, said Jerry Clayton, the sheriff in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's so hypocritical to criticize the community around no snitching, an unwritten rule on the street that police officers say prevents them from solving crimes. And then we turn around and say, I can talk about that thing that happened. Michael Harrison was the chief who started the training in New Orleans in 2015 with the help of Irvin Staub, a psychologist and Holocaust survivor who has studied the dynamics of bystander intervention. Michael Harrison brought the program with him to Baltimore, Maryland, where he's now the commissioner. At both police departments, he has been charged with correcting a pattern of constitutional violations under agreements with the Justice Department known as consent decrees. Historically, loyalty was looked at as, if I confide in you, you keep my secret, Commissioner Harrison said. We started teaching loyalty should be displayed on the front end to prevent potential injury, death, career ruin, or even worse. The bottom line, he said, let me help you not make this mistake in the first place. In the 2 years after New Orleans trained its police officers, the number of canine bites, police shootings, vehicle chases, and use of force complaints dropped. Because of other changes mandated by the consent decree, it is not clear how much of those declines are attributable to intervention training. But close observers like Jonathan Aroney, the federal monitor, say it helped change department culture. In Baltimore this month, the trainees acted out scenarios that might call for intervention. In one police officer begins an illegal search of a woman's car. In another, a supervisor pressures a police officer to pretend he did not hear a suspect ask for a lawyer, a request that normally would put an end to an interrogation.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, I have the honor and pleasure of being joined by my darling sister and special guest, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, my dear?
I'm very good, thank you. On this episode of Muslim Lady, we're talking about the expectations of society from Muslim women. We have tried to sort of dissect this subject and try to find the root cause for certain angles of it. The branch we've reached at this point has been that the society and women and men alike have deviated a lot from how a Muslim woman should be. And along came the Islamic Revolution and redefined these lines and these roles. for women and for the society to understand, accept a lot. But then again, it's a work in progress and it's not easy. Just recently, we were talking about a common standard both Muslim men and women should be having. It's an attribute that was most salient in the late Sardar Qasim Soleimani, and it was sincerity, khulus.
Yeah, pure faith and sincerity.
Pure intentions.
Something that I really, really love about the personality of Lady Fatima, Salamullah alayha, is this same feature,
mm-hmm.
right? Where do I get it from? I get it from the Quran, from this story that I'm going to tell you about that you guys all know, but then I want you to look at it from a new perspective. This is in chapter Al-Insan, which is verse number 9, chapter number 76, right?
Yep.
So this is a flag that the Holy Quran raises up and places on the door of the house door of Lady Fatima az-Zahra, salamullah alayha, where the lady says, the family says, we only feed you. You know, three people come to them. Mm. Yatiman.
Miskinan
wa asira, right? Mm. And every time they needed this really for themselves because they hadn't had food for like so many days and they were fasting and this was their iftar and this was just a loaf of bread.
Mm.
And they were needier of it themselves. But then Ali alayhi salam addresses his lovely wife and he says that, look, what do you think we should do? They decide to offer their food to them. So the Quran says, narrating them, that we only feed you for Allah's sake. You show that you're doing something, but then your heart is something else. This is the problem with the...
I blame our nafs. Sometimes we're just the only people to blame.
Exactly. So, and then he says, we desire from you neither reward nor thanks. Where nowadays we only work for money. Mostly. We work for money. One of my friends went to a psychologist a couple of months ago. She was doing religious work. She was doing cultural work. And she was feeling very tensed and depressed. And, you know, she wasn't feeling calm and she wasn't feeling well. And the psychologist told her, she was a religious psychologist. She said, for some time, do everything for free. Do some of the things, not everything, because you have to run your life. But some of the things... Fight with your nafs.
Mm.
You want to earn money, you want to get money, and you get good money, but fight it. Do it for God, for free, right? And then a couple of days ago, I was actually thinking about this. When materialism is pressuring me, pressuring my whole, who I am, my identity, and I'm just moving towards making more money, becoming more famous and this and that, I have to leash my nafs, protect it, I have to control it. How? By sometimes... working for free. The lady says, we want nothing from you. We desire from you neither reward nor thanks. We only do it only for the sake of Allah.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Bringing this back to the main topic of our conversation, which is what the society expects of a Muslim lady. Okay, tell me, how are you planning to connect the dots here?
Exactly. The first thing that we should consider is to work on ourselves.
Yeah, and then once we do that, we really don't give a rat's whisker what society expects. No matter how I look at this, I feel that who is society to expect anything from me?
What I mean by society is the Islamic government. Let's say we are establishing a government based on the value system of Islam. You know, let's say it's the end of time. Let's say it's the time of the arrival, reappearance of Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala. And we're going to be the leaders of the... We're going to be some kind of leaders leading the women's society. What kind of a woman should we be? So the first quality that we should work on ourselves is to be sincere and faithful individuals.
Mm.
Sincerity of faith is the most important thing. This is something which I love about the story of Lady Asiya. You know, at the time that she was making a prayer, it's one of the ayahs in the Quran, I remember which ayah, but then she makes a wish, she makes a dua, prayer, she desires something, and that is that I want a place near my Lord. Mm. I want a house near my Lord. She was so wealthy. She was just submerged with money. Her husband,
comfort and luxury.
Power. Everything.
Mm. The most extravagant lifestyle ever.
Imagine.
And then she was like, nah, this means none.
And I want a house near him. Cleopatra, right? Mm. Everybody knows her. Mm. And you connect her with luxury.
And success.
And success and power.
Achievement.
And achievement. Asiya was even more influential. She was the wife of the pharaoh. Mm. She could have been more important than Cleopatra. Mm. But then what she desired was just one thing. I want a house near Allah. It shows her sincerity, doesn't it?
I guess the only way for us to be able to reinforce that sincerity within ourselves is through practice. Because, you know, we know so very little about the life of Lady Asiya. Where was she from? How was she raised? How did she end up being a monotheist?
She was a daughter of a very rich person.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how did she end up being her in that status, right? And it just, the whole thing just is so ambiguous and so shrouded, and we don't know much about her. So
we don't
just
need
gotta,
to know much.
Exactly. So we just got to focus on ourselves at this point and think about how we can practice.
Exactly. We only need to know one thing about her, which we do know.
Yeah, exactly.
That she was someone who, despite being in the company of a filthy rich guy and a tyrant
time,
of her time, but then she wasn't influenced, you see? Us and being influenced by our time, it's possible not to be influenced by what goes on in our world. And that is what makes us, our generation, so super powerful. Mm. That is why the Prophet is so proud of us. That we have all these options, you know? A good person shines out when that good person is
surrounded by
bad people, right? And so our art, our achievement, our real achievement at this time is that we are surrounded by so many darknesses and so many rival thoughts and doctrines, but we choose the best. And it is so hard, Zainab.
It is.
So hard. I'm just saying it with words. And sometimes I'm so shameful of myself that, you know, I'm saying I'm putting more burdens on myself. Mm. Because I really do try my best in my life. But then we know what the right path is. We say it.
Okay, so basically whatever society is expecting of us, what's important is for us to purify our intentions and focus it on just pleasing God.
Where the social media is exactly the opposite. How many likes do I have? How many views do I have? How many people have wrote comments
for me? Yeah,
but
then again, that also depends on what...
Your intention is?
Yes.
Your intention gets blurred in the middle of the way, Zainab.
Well, no one said it's going to be easy.
No,
was it easy for Lady Asiya?
No,
it really wasn't.
No
one said it's going to be easy. When I think about, like, Sayyidah Fatima, salamullah alayha, I often think that you had two children who had been sick for a week. You fasted, they fasted, now they're starving, and you chose to give your entire food to a stranger at the door.
And then you say, I don't want anything from you.
Make sense, you know?
Yeah.
You could have just, I don't know, half-half. Save half.
I would have done that.
Bread. I would have done that too.
I know. I feel like I'm a human being too.
And you know, I think that is what it means. I want nothing from you. I want nothing from this pasta. Not even half of this bread. I want to keep for myself. I want all of it for you.
But why?
Because... I have my eyes on what God is going to give me.
You have, exactly, this comes from...
Exactly. It comes from nothing else but firm belief and strong faith. Whatever no matter what problem we have in life, it still stems from the fact that our iman is faulty. Every problem, it's not Hollywood, it's not social media, it's not saqifa, it's because our iman is faulty. And often I think to myself, I'm just reminding myself, no one said it's going to be easy, that if I had a strong faith, my iman was strong and fortified enough, it wouldn't matter to me whether or not there are double standards, whether or not society's expectations of me are realistic, whether or not I'm getting likes or no likes on Instagram, whether or not I'm getting paid for this, because I would have my eyes on what God has for me. Like Lady Asiya, she was like, I don't care if I lose this luxury. I don't care if I lose my queen status, my tiara. I don't care if you squish me with a boulder, which is what she ended up. I've got my eyes on what God has for me, right?
But that is so...
Exactly, but it's not supposed to be easy.
Difficult.
Like, look at Haj Qasim, or look at Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah alayh.
You know, I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. And I think one big impediment that is on our way that really, like, takes us to the other direction is materialism.
Of course.
If we were happy with the little that we have, if we didn't expect, like, for this hotel, for that trip, for this, you know, brand clothes, for this shoes, for that house, for that car, for this food, this dessert, this, that, this, right? Then everything would be so much easier for us. Because in my mind, if I want to define success, I say, I look at that blogger and I look at that influencer. Look at her life. Look at her house, man.
Look at her wardrobe.
Exactly. Look at the colors of her wall. Yeah. Everything is so matching. Look at her cups. Look at her. Look at the desserts that she has. Look at the vacations that she goes on. I want to be like that. So that shapes my expectations of life. This is where I want to achieve. This is what I want to head towards.
That becomes my objective rather than satisfying Allah.
Exactly. Exactly. This is our biggest challenge.
Yeah, so there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. His Eminence says that zuhd,
contentment with the very least in life,
doesn't mean not owning anything. Rather, it means nothing owns you. Because sometimes I think to myself, am I living a lavish lifestyle? But then I think, well, number one, my food's got to be on spot, because if I don't eat, I'll faint. I won't be able to do anything. I won't be able to pray. I won't be able to fast. I won't be able to do ibadah. And I'm a woman.
And it has to be good, nutritious,
good food. That tastes well on my palate, because I'm a picky eater.
Totally agree with you.
I have a very sensitive stomach.
I totally agree.
You know?
I haven't had food for 2-3 days.
And
like proper food.
Faint.
And I feel like my whole energy is just soaked out of my body.
Exactly. And
now
women.
I understand the value of nutritious food.
Yeah, so this is, we're women.
Put this aside.
Yeah, okay. So my food has to be my comfort to an extent.
Imam Ali himself, he said, you guys are
flowers.
Flowers.
I'm a woman. I need a certain degree of comfort and ease so that I can get other things done.
So we're justifying everything.
Yeah, no, and it's justifiable. I'm talking about basic needs.
But you know, when we're saying al-mar'atu rayhana, it means that in another ahadith from Ali alayhi salam, he says that do not put women to heavy work.
Exactly. And more on that on future episodes of Muslim Lady. Until then, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our
return. Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. In the limelight.
Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alfred W. McCoy, writer. This article is published under the heading, Melting of Ice Sheets is Dramatic, but Melting of Permafrost Means Mass Death. Stay tuned for more. When midnight strikes on New Year's Day of 2050, there will be little cause for celebration. But for most of humanity, it will just be another day of adversity bordering on misery, a desperate struggle to find food, water, shelter, and safety. In the previous decades, storm surges will have swept away coastal barriers erected at enormous cost, and rising seas will have flooded the downtowns of major cities that once housed more than 100 million people. Relentless waves will pound shorelines around the world, putting villages, towns, and cities at risk. As several hundred million climate change refugees in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia fill leaky boats or trudge overland in a desperate search for food and shelter, affluent nations worldwide will be trying to shut their borders even tighter, pushing crowds back in tear gas and gunfire. Yet those reluctant host countries, including the United States, won't faintly be immune from the pain. Every summer, in fact, ever more powerful hurricanes propelled by climate change will pummel the east and U.S. Gulf Coast of this country, possibly even forcing the federal government to abandon Miami and New Orleans to the rising tides. Meanwhile, wildfires, already growing in size in 2021, will devastate vast stretches of the West, destroying thousands upon thousands of homes every summer and fall in an ever-expanding fire season. This dismaled vision of life circa 2050 comes not from some flight of literary fantasy, but from published environmental science. Indeed, we can all see the troubling signs of global warming around us right now, worsening wildfires, ever more severe ocean storms, and increased coastal flooding. While the world is focused on the fiery spectacle of wildfires destroying swathes of Australia, Brazil, California, and Canada, a far more serious threat threat is developing, only half attended to. In the planet's remote polar regions, not only are the ice caps melting with frightening speed, already raising sea levels worldwide, but the vast Arctic permafrost is fast receding, releasing enormous stores of lethal greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. At that frozen frontier far beyond our ken or consciousness, ecological changes brewing largely invisibly deep beneath the Arctic tundra will accelerate global warming in the ways sure to inflict untold future misery on all of us. More than any of other place or problem, the thawing of Arctic frozen earth, which covers vast parts of the roof of the world, will shape humanity's fate for the rest of the century, destroying cities, devastating nations, and rupturing the current global order. In assessing the likely course of climate change by 2050, one question is paramount. How quickly will we feel its impact? For decades, scientists thought that climate change would arrive at what science writer Eugene Linden called stately pace. In 1975, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences still felt that it would take centuries for the climate to change in a meaningful way. As late as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, concluded that the Arctic permafrost, which stores both staggering amounts of carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, an even more dangerous greenhouse gas, was not yet melting and that the Antarctic ice sheets remained stable. In 1993, however, scientists began studying ice cores extracted from Greenland's ice cap and found that there had been 25 rapid climate change events in the last glacial period thousands of years ago, showing that the climate could change massively within a decade or two. Driven by a growing scientific consensus about the dangers facing humanity, representatives of 196 states met in 2015 in Paris, where they agreed to commit themselves to a 45% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and achieve net carbon neutrality by 2050 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This, they argued, would be sufficient to avoid the disastrous impacts sure to come at 2 degrees Celsius degrees or higher. However, the bright hopes of that Paris conference faded quickly. Within 3 years, the scientific community realized that the cascading effects of global warming reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would be evident not in the distant future of 2100, but perhaps by 2040, impacting most adults alive today. The medium-term effects of climate change will only be amplified by the uneven way the planet is warming, with a far heavier impact in the Arctic. According to a Washington Post analysis, by 2018, the world already had hot spots that had recorded an average rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial norm. As the sun strikes tropical latitudes, huge columns of warm air rise and then are pushed toward the poles by greenhouse gases trapped in the atmosphere until they drop down to Earth at higher latitudes, creating spots with faster rising temperatures in the West Asia region, Western Europe, and above all, the Arctic. In a 2018 IPCC Doomsday report, its scientists warned that even at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, temperature increases would be unevenly distributed globally and could possibly reach a devastating 4.5 degrees Celsius in the Arctic high altitudes, with profound consequences for the entire planet. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. At the hotter end in Africa, Australia, and the Amazon, warmer temperatures will spark ever more devastating forest fires, reducing tree cover and releasing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. This in turn, as is already happening, will fuel yet more fires and so create a monstrous self-reinforcing feedback loop that could decimate the great tropical rainforests of this planet. The even more serious and uncontrollable driver, however, will be in the planet's polar regions. There, an Arctic feedback loop is already gaining a self-sustaining momentum that could soon move beyond humanity's capacity to control it. By mid-century or before, as ice sheets continue to melt disastrously in Greenland and Antarctica, rising oceans will make extreme sea level events like once-in-a-century storm surges and flooding annual occurrences in many areas. If global warming grows beyond the maximum 2 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement, depending on what happens to Antarctica's ice sheets, ocean levels could increase by a staggering 43 inches as this century ends. In fact, a worst-case scenario by the National Academies of Sciences projects a sea level rise of as much as 20 inches by 2050 and 78 inches in 2100, with a catastrophic loss of 690,000 square miles of land and expanse 4 times the size of California, displacing about 2.5% of the world's population and inundating major cities like New York. Adding to such concerns, a recent study in Nature predicted that by 2060, rain rather than snow could dominate parts of the Arctic, further accelerating ice loss and raising sea levels significantly. Moving that doomsday ever closer, recent satellite imagery reveals that the ice shelf holding back Antarctica's massive De Weisz Glacier could shatter within 3 to 5 years, quickly breaking that Florida-sized frozen mass into hundreds of icebergs and eventually resulting in several feet of sea level rise on its own.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.